Welcome to Scientific American Science Talk, posted on February 27th, 2020. I'm Steve Mirsky. On this episode,
there appears to be what we would call a missing microbiome. And in those individuals with the missing microbiome, they appear to be much higher at risk for these autoimmune and these other immune diseases that present early in life.
That's Ben Wiegand. He received a doctorate in physical chemistry from Harvard. You may have seen bumper stickers that say, honk if you pass PChem. Wiegand is now the global head of the World Without Disease Accelerator, the WWDA, at Janssen, the pharmaceutical companies of Johnson & Johnson, where he's involved in multiple efforts to prevent disease or identify it in its earliest stages for more effective treatments. We spoke by phone. What is the WWDA?
So the WWDA, or we would call the World Without Disease Accelerator, our focus is trying to positively affect the future of healthcare. We realize that today, as people get older, they're living longer. But unfortunately, almost half of people that are 40 years or older have multiple comorbidities. And by 65, 95% of Americans will have two or more comorbidities. So while they're living longer lives, we have what I call passengers along the ride with us, whether it's diabetes or Alzheimer's or hypertension. And so our idea and our vision is that we would, you know, if we had our choice of how to live in life, we'd want to live longer, healthier lives, not longer, unhealthier lives. And so the World Without Disease mission is to try to address that. And so to address disease, we want to either prevent, intercept, or cure disease so that we can maintain optimum health and live the longest, fullest life possible.
So let's get into some actual nuts and bolts on how to do that. I mean, you mentioned diabetes as one of those comorbidities, and obviously there's been, we're in the midst of a type 2 diabetes explosion, but I understand that you're doing a lot of type 1 work.
While we're thankful for the innovation of insulin, which was developed in 1922, unfortunately, even with continuous glucose monitoring, the average type 1 diabetic has a reduced lifespan of about 10 to 18 years. And I'd like to tell you just a quick story about Kaisi Terry, a young girl, 5-year-old, full of energy, never was sick a day in her life. One Sunday, she goes to church. When she came home that day, she didn't feel well. When she woke up the next morning, she didn't feel the best, so her parents asked her to stay home from school. They thought she probably had the flu. Friday, they realized something was going on. They took her to the emergency room where she was diagnosed with diabetic ketoacidosis, type 1 diabetes, with a blood glucose level of over 1,000, which obviously is well out of range. She suffered a couple seizures. And unfortunately, this beautiful 5-year-old Kaisi never saw her 6th birthday. Now, why is that? It's because type 1 diabetes, like a number of different diseases, are asymptomatic. And we realized that Kaisi wasn't healthy Saturday night and all of a sudden became sick overnight. Rather, there was a lot of underlying disease biology and pathophysiology that had been happening over a number of years in her life that went undetected by the normal clinical symptoms that one would normally measure. And so what we try to do is to say, how can we identify people at risk for disease? How can we screen them or predict those individuals who are progressing toward disease and then develop interventions that could either prevent or intercept the disease while it's happening?
So in the case of a child with type 1 diabetes, what kind of testing can go on? Because, you know, a kid might not see a doctor for 6 months or a year, and the entire condition could manifest between doctor visits. So what kind of things could be in the pipeline to make that kind of monitoring more ongoing?
We are today working on a sensor that would be put in the diaper that could measure, you know, glucose spilling from the urine into the diaper. Because these processes don't happen that fast, we don't believe that the child would have to wear a diaper every day, but potentially could wear one, you know, once a month. We know the major seroconversion is between, you know, 8 months to about 24 months. And so one could easily envision, you know, handing, you know, at-risk children, or even in Finland, you know, where one out of every 100 Finns have type 1 diabetes, you could provide that as a part of what they would call today their baby box, where they hand to all mothers at birth, you know, a pack of 15 diapers that could be worn once a month. And if the sensor went off that says, look, we're seeing glucose an abnormal amount of glucose in the urine, you know, they could do additional screening that would be very passive versus what would have to be done today with traditional blood samples.
Let's talk about the baby box, because I know that you've been involved in some of the baby box upgrading work. It's such a fascinating concept to me that we don't have here in the U.S., but it seems like such a simple and yet incredibly effective intervention.
The concept of the baby box was an attempt by the Finnish government, which has been very successful, to help provide healthy behaviors to mom and child during what we would call the first 2 years of life, which where we believe, and now science is encouraging us that this is true, that there's a lot of health trajectory is set in those early childhood months. And so making sure the child has good eating, good sleeping, good hygiene, behaviors. And so the Finnish government would provide a box, one, just to help make sure they had a safe place to sleep, but second, to provide solutions in that box to help them in during the first 2 years of the life has been very important in the overall health of the Finnish children. What we're now saying is, now that we have digital solutions, are there additional diagnostics, diapers with glucose sensors, or other things that we could put into that box to help in the health of the children? And we held what we call a quick fire challenge in concert with the Finnish a business organization to help identify ideas that could be included in that box. And we have some really good ideas. We're now transitioning those ideas from concept into practice. And we hope to be able to incorporate those into the baby box in the near future.
Basically, the mom, before she leaves the hospital, gets a box. The box is, for one thing, it's a crib that the baby can sleep in if the family doesn't have a crib. And it's filled with just some basic items that you need to make sure that the baby is well taken care of. And, you know, for the cost, it's so cost effective. I mean, it's not free. It gets paid for with tax money, but the returns in terms of how much money the baby does not cost is just incredible.
No, and I think one of the things you highlighted, Steve, which is important, is that in the Finnish, being able to set the child on a healthy trajectory, not only is providing short-term benefits, and as you mentioned, in our Healthy Baby Initiative, we believe, as we've seen over the last number of years, significant rates increasing in the rates and prevalence of things like food allergy, asthma, as well as atopic dermatitis. You know, these are autoimmune and other immunological conditions. We think that we can help get ahead of the disease. And so not only are we making a difference in the early life of these individuals, but again, healthier infants, we believe, will lead to healthier adults later in life. We do know the flip side, that individuals that are obese when they're young, often are the ones that are obese when they're older and then lead to diabetes. So our ability to get ahead of the disease in these places and to be able to give mom, you know, simple solutions that they can integrate into their daily life. Because I think as we do our research, and I think from our own experiences, you know, mothers with young children are very open to changing behavior and very open to give their children the best they possibly can. Sometimes as we get a little bit older, we can get distracted by other things and it may be harder for us to change behaviors. But we realize at a young age, it's a very unique and what we call aha moment, where we can have very teachable moments to provide these good health behaviors.
Everybody's into the microbiome these days. And the microbiome also comes into play in the Healthy Baby Initiative.
No, it's correct. And, you know, one of the things that we're learning, and I think the field of the microbiome is exploding, and we're learning more and more every day about its role, both in terms of immune training, as well as potentially even as a diagnostic for either individuals progressing toward disease, as well as for as potential as a way to determine treatments, in a disease. And you're seeing some of that in the immuno-oncology space later on in life. What we focus more from an immune from a Healthy Baby Initiative is twofold. One is what we have seen and what has been observed from a correlative perspective, so today we can't say it's causative, is that individuals that have a C-section versus a vaginal birth, or early babies that have had usage of antibiotics early in life, have a very, very different microbiome, a gut microbiome, than individuals who have a normal vaginal birth. And what is interesting is there appears to be what we would call a missing microbiome. And in those individuals with the missing microbiome, they appear to be much higher at risk for these autoimmune and these other immune diseases that present early in life. The interesting thing is that microbiome, the role of that bacteria has been really to digest the human milk oligosaccharides from a mother's breast milk into short chain fatty acids and other metabolites that seem to help train the immune system to recognize self from non-self. The amazing thing is you can see a large difference that is present in the gut. It's shown as simply as measuring the pH of a baby's stool. There's a difference of over a log, which is a very significant difference. And so we're exploring ways to restore the microbiome of those individuals to put them on a healthy trajectory.
So one log, that means one full pH point.
That's correct.
Okay. This is a fascinating idea, the digital twins.
Yeah, no, I think, right now with our ability to measure so many different elements about an individual, you may have recently seen last year we announced a partnership with Apple. By using their Apple iWatch platform, we can take periodic measures of heart rate and ECG to identify people that may be at risk for stroke by measuring individuals that are in atrial fibrillation. In addition to that, obviously, there's a number of other markers around activity and gait and heart availability. And so we believe now with all this information supplemented by, obviously, genomic and other blood biomarkers, just as with our cars, we have all these sensors that we know when the car comes off the assembly line. We know what is the right tire pressure, oil pressure, engine temperature, et cetera, is that we should have. We now should be able to create a digital twin of individuals or babies when they're born. And as we would then take these passive measures, as you said, through diapers or through other non-invasive wearables, one could get early signs that, you're moving a little bit off course for your health, and then sensors could go off. And again, just like we try to do with our in the Apple iWatch study, it's not every time something goes off. For us, we want to see, five measures within a period of time that says you're in atrial fibrillation. You then would confirm. We then send an alert and encourage you to go visit a doctor for the final diagnosis. One could use the digital twin concept to help individuals maintain and ensure that they're on the right trajectory for health. And obviously, if you go back in my day, my first computer game was, I think we played computer Pong with a little stick and the ball went back and forth. And now computer games are very different. We see digital twins, today maybe in that early state, but truly an opportunity to be able to predict future health.
We've been talking a lot about young people and babies. There's lung cancer work, I understand, that you're involved with as well. Now, colon cancer, we have systems to get early detection on colon cancer, but early stage lung cancer is very hard to determine. A lot of times people get a diagnosis by accident because, they broke a rib and they go in for an X-ray and that's how they find it. Otherwise, they don't find out about lung cancer until it's pretty advanced. So what's in the works to get better early detection for lung cancer, and what would early detection mean?
75% of people that are diagnosed with cancer, lung cancer, are late stage, so either stage 3 or stage 4. And while we have seen some improvements in the 5-year progression-free survival rate for those individuals, it's still a modest improvement over the last, frankly, 40 years. Clearly, as we go either to stage 1, stage 2, we believe now that we can actually identify, there are desires and reasons to believe we could identify people even earlier in disease. We think we can make a bigger difference. If you could just improve you know, let's say take, 50% of the people identified now in stage one and stage two, you could almost double the 5-year survival rate for all lung cancer individuals with no new treatments. And obviously, we're making tremendous improvements on the treatments. So what does that mean? What it means is today the primary screening is low-dose CT screening. And so unfortunately, a lot of times the images that result are inconclusive. And you see nodules and that you're not sure are they malignant or benign. And so we're working using artificial intelligence to help us train algorithms to be able to predict one way or the other. There's some recent technology that we're really excited about, this concept of a field of injury that the lung is reflective of the entire airway. And so if we could take samples from the nose or bronchus or other more easier to achieve or easier to access areas, we could get understanding of early damage in life. And what we're seeing, and this is published work by Dr. Avi Spira, who is now the head of our lung cancer initiative here at Johnson & Johnson, is that when you see this, when you find these early conditions, you often see a very immunocompromised individual. And so ability to reactivate the immune system, we think could be an early way, easy way to intercept the disease.
In addition to the conditions that we've already discussed, what other diseases, conditions, syndromes do you think you can make a difference with?
So I think, you mentioned one already, which is colorectal cancer. And I think the key thing for us in any of these cases, Steve, is our ability to understand the cause of disease. You know, we want to understand, the root cause of the disease. And so our ability to understand disease biology really is critical for us to say, why would we go after type 1 diabetes or lung cancer or some of these healthy baby initiatives, or in this case, colon cancer? Because we believe we understand a lot about some of the disease-initiating events, which would help us, as you said, find these earlier people. So colorectal cancer is one that we're working on. We have some early work that's going on there. We are looking at a wide range of other, immune or oncology conditions that can, again, where we think we have a better understanding of disease biology. But at the bottom line is we have to be able to find the people first. And then by understanding the disease biology, we have to provide them solutions. You know, we really want to make sure that we're not just coming up with, identifying people and telling them they're at risk for disease and not having any solution, for them to address their disease. So those are the levers that we're trying to pull. And what we found is that by partnering with, I think that's an important piece. Well, we have a team of about 100 here at Janssen. We're working with a global set of external innovators, whether they're at academic institutions, small biotechs, these patient advocacy groups. And, I would say at least once a month, people come to us and say, have you thought about this disease? Someone came to us recently and talked to us about multiple sclerosis. We think we know how to find the people. We think we understand the disease biology. And so we're always very open to hearing ideas and advocates from the outside, because we know this is not something that Janssen can do all by ourselves, but rather we really are trying to build this coalition of the willing to be ultimately successful, to live into this concept of a world without disease.
Yeah, it's the old saying, an ounce of prevention, it's worth about 100 million pounds of cure. I understand that I don't know what it is, but I understand you have a personal story that has really informed your enthusiasm for the work.
About 4 years ago, I can still remember as if it was Sunday morning. I think it was 2:47 in the morning. I got a phone call, and it was the critical care nurse at Carle Clinic in Urbana, Illinois. It's a town that I grew up in about 50 years ago. And, the woman told me, says, your father's just had a heart attack. And, at 2:47, you're not really thinking clear in the morning. You're not thinking clearly anyway. But in my mind, I had just seen my father a couple weeks ago, and he was doing great. He was 87 years old, so he wasn't young, but he was always active. He exercised every day. His mind was good. And it was a struggle for me to say, he was healthy just a couple weeks ago. How could he have just had a heart attack? And, for me, it was like, how could we get ahead of this disease? I jumped in a plane, flew out to Illinois, and I talked to my dad, and I think it was almost the first words out of his mouth after I saw him there in the ICU. He said, "Ben, what could I have done to prevent this?" He was very thankful for the nurses and the doctors. They gave him a couple stents. He's on a couple medications. he's done really, really, really well. But you know, for him is, how could he have prevented this? That's what he wanted to know. Why did I have to go through this? And again, he was in excellent shape, wasn't overweight, low stress. So it wasn't like he had poor lifestyle behaviors. And yet we know this disease had been happening for a long period of time. And it was, and would there be, and that's my mission, is there some way to be able to predict these diseases before they happen so that we don't have to go through these really life-changing events? And I'm thankful, you know, my father's healthy. Unfortunately, a number of people don't have that same outcome. So that's my mission, is to really to get ahead of the disease so that parents can be with their children and their grandchildren, and the world can be, you know, a better place, that people don't look back on. I think, because I do think people will look back on us someday and say, can you imagine they waited till they got a disease before they treated it? Because that's what we're doing today. We're treating disease. We're not getting ahead of it.
Right. So your dad is now 91?
He is. No, he's absolutely, he's 91. I actually just spent last weekend with him, and his mind is good. You know, he's 91, so he's not running any marathons, but I'm thankful that he still has a good life ahead of him.
That's it for this episode. Get your science news at our website, www.scientificamerican.com, where we're bringing you the latest news and insights about coronavirus. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, where you'll get a tweet whenever a new item hits the website. Our Twitter name is @SciAm. For Scientific American Science Talk, I'm Steve Mirsky. Thanks for clicking on us.